Hey, good morning, everybody. Bio 231 lecture students. Welcome to class. It's May 11th, Monday. And I'm going to turn a couple of these lights down for right now, like so. And maybe like that. Yeah, let's do that for a little bit, unless it's too dark. Raise your hand if it's too dark. I can't see anybody's hand, so it doesn't matter. Okay, sign-in sheets going around. And this is 231, May 11th. Let's take a look at the schedule. We're going to start urinary system today, finish up digestive system. We don't have too much to do with digestive system, just have some fun talking about it, I think. And then move into diversification system on Wednesday and Monday of next week. And then a week and a half from today is your last exam, exam number 4. I could call it a final exam because it's the last exam, but it's not cumulative. It's just over these chapters right here that you see, right? Also, next week is going to be testing and lab. We won't be doing any lab exercises. We just have a practicum. Some of you have a quiz during that week as well. Some need to take quiz number 10. I believe that's the Monday group is going to take quiz number 10 after the practicum. All right, so don't forget, pay attention. Those of you that have lab on Wednesday, you're going to get two quizzes this week because that's what you guys requested, so that you don't have to take any quiz next week. Quiz number 10 next week, you're going to take it this week. But there is a lecture exam covering just these chapters, right? It's not cumulative. And the fourth practicum either before or after the lecture exam, depending on when your lab is. And hopefully that material reinforces itself, or that the practicum reinforces what you have to know for a lecture. So hopefully that helps you out. So you might be a little fatigued thereafter. And then after that, May 20th, that's the end of class. Oh, you know what? That's not the end of class, because Thursday, May 21st, is the deadline for your last online assignment. All right, so the class really isn't over until May 21st. And so I'll probably get some grades started probably Friday morning, something like that. And chances are I'm not going to have time to show you your lecture exams right after lecture. Sometimes I did that, but probably not for this exam. Probably going to take me 24 hours to get it done. Okay. Anybody have a question over the schedule? I think I just want to say, I think I can remember what's on the fourth practicum. It's going to be labs number 9, 11, 12, and 13. 9, 11, 12, and 13, because you've already been tested on lab number 10. All right, so I think that's all I know. So any questions? Any questions over what we talked about last time? Changing topics a little bit. Anything from last time? I guess I got a couple questions then. Let's see, is this it? Yeah, okay. This is it. All right, so make sure you know the layers of the digestive tract or the alimentary canal, and you have to know that for lab as well. There's a nice model that shows the different layers. And we talked about the small and something about the large intestine, not a whole lot. I guess that's where we got to pick up. Maybe a little bit about the pancreas, but talked about the small intestine. Okay, so what does the oral cavity, the stomach, the small intestine, and we're going to actually see the large intestine. They have, well, no, sorry, oral cavity, stomach, and small intestine. What do they all have in common? Oral cavity, stomach, small intestine. What do they have in common? I think maybe I heard it. Ah, they have a mucous membrane, sure, because it's a tube that's really outside your body, right? It's a tube that's open to the outside world, just so happens to curl around inside your body. I like that a lot, okay? And there's another thing, too. And I think I'm going to just kind of give you a hint. I'm going to go back to this very first slide right here, salivary glands. I don't have much in salivary glands, but what do I have for salivary glands in your lecture notes? Fluid. Yeah, fluid. How much fluid is lost from your body because your salivary glands make it and secrete it into your oral cavity every day? So about 1.5 liters, right? You lose 1.5 liters of fluid every day from your body, because remember, your alimentary canal is really outside your body. What about the stomach? I think I have it here. At least I hope I have it here. Ah, look, another 1.5 liters of fluid secreted outside your body. So that's 3 liters so far. And what about the small intestine? Do you lose water because your small intestine is secreting? Yes, almost 2 liters. Right, so that's 5 liters of fluid you lose from your body just to support the functions of your oral cavity, your stomach, and your small intestine. All right, so don't forget that number, 5 liters, 5 liters. We talked about surface area, right, and surface area is important for transport, in particular absorption in the alimentary canal. And when I say surface area, what is the everyday item that you should think of? A doorway, that's right. And is a doorway directly related to absorption or inversely related? Directly means if the doorway gets bigger, what about absorption? Does it get faster or more? More, so it's directly related, right? So the bigger the doorway, the faster, the more absorption can take place. So remember, the function of the small intestine is digestion and absorption, so I would guess that the small intestine should have a large doorway or surface area for absorption. And I think it's really important that you know the 3 specializations of the small intestine that increase the surface area or the doorway for absorption. Starting with something you can see, ending up with something you can't see that's microscopic. So I guess maybe I'll pull up a cross-section of that small intestine someplace. Where's that nice cross-section of small intestine? Down here, down here, down here. Ah, here it is right here. That shows 2 of the specializations. The small intestine has these circular folds, the plicae circularis. All right. And in order to, if we were going to measure the surface area, we'd have to pull the small intestine to straighten out all of these plicae to really know how long a tube it is. In reality, what else would we have to pull to straighten out? All of these villi that line the plicae. Right? So we'd have to keep pulling. And then there's one other thing that increases the surface area for absorption. And that is what you learned probably the very first week of class, microvilli. Right? So all of these folds on the apical surface of this cell, we call it a brush border sometimes, is there to increase surface area, to increase absorption of nutrients. Right? We also talked about this villus, okay, and the various kinds of vessels in it, and I can see some mucosa-associated lymphoid tissue here and here, all over the place, right, to protect you from infection. And I'm sure we talked about the divisions. How many divisions are there in the small intestine? Yeah, 3, and you should know their correct order, which is duodenum, I like, jejunum, and then ileum, and the ileum attaches to the large intestine at a particular place, which is what? The cecum. That's right, and there's a circular smooth muscle there that controls or regulates the flow from the small intestine into the large, and that's called the ileocecal valve. All right, well, you know, if we pull all of these folds out, if we pull all of those plicae circulares so it's straight, if we pull all of the villi out so that it is straight, so there's none of these bumps right here, and we keep pulling to pull all of these microvilli so it's a nice flat surface, what is the surface area for exchange? And I remember I didn't tell you that. Okay. The surface area of the small intestine, okay, if it was just a simple tube, if it didn't have any of these specializations, would be 3.5 square feet. And what was this doorway over here? That was 2 square meters, so that 2 square meters is a lot bigger than 2.5 square feet, right, because a meter is 3 times a foot. So that just gives you a sense of how big it is, which is not very impressive. But, you know, if we straighten out all of those folds, look what happens to the surface area. It goes to 2,200 square feet, right, or 47 times 47. Feet. That's how much it would be, 47 times 47, or 240 square meters. That's the floor area of an average two-level house. That's the doorway for absorption in your digestive tract. So that, I think, that always impressed me. All right, and don't forget the vascular structures for absorption are twofold in the small intestine. Capillaries absorb amino acids and sugars, monosaccharides, right? And we know capillaries are important for exchange, right? So capillaries, vascular capillaries, absorb the building blocks of proteins and the building blocks of complex sugars. But the building blocks of lipids are not absorbed by a blood vessel. What are they absorbed by? A lacteal, which is a special lymphatic capillary, still a capillary, right? Therefore exchange, but it's part of the lymphatic system. Okay, and then fats are combined with chemicals that form what we call chylomicrons, which allow those lipids to be carried by the blood. All right, let's move on to pancreas. Pancreas has two excretory functions. One is exocrine and one is endocrine. Can anybody remember what an exocrine gland is? By definition, it's an anatomical definition, exocrine gland. It has a duct that carries the product, okay, to wherever it's supposed to go, right? So an exocrine gland has a duct. An exocrine gland secretes that product into a duct, and the duct carries it wherever it should go. For instance, here are some enzymes, trypsin, chymotrypsin. These are important for digesting proteins. Pancreatic amylase for digestion of, you should write in your notes, complex sugars like starch, right? And then pancreatic lipase. What's the substrate for lipase? That's part of the name, right? This is nice modern nomenclature. It's an enzyme because there's an ASE right here. The beginning part of the word tells you the substrate. It is lipid, right? Okay, so for digestion of lipids. So if you have enzymes in the pancreas that can digest proteins and digest polysaccharides and digest lipids, you can basically break the whole pancreas down into its building blocks. You can completely digest the pancreas. All right, so that would not be good. So the exocrine function of the pancreas is to produce all of these enzymes, right, and not secrete them into the interstitial space in an active form, but they're secreted into a duct which carries it into the small intestine so the pancreas doesn't get self-digested. And even then, when they get into the small intestine, that's where they're really activated. Right, but so that's the exocrine function. Endocrine function. What the heck is an endocrine gland? Yeah, it secretes not into a duct, right, but into the interstitial space, and then that product is absorbed by the circulatory system, by a capillary. And once it's in the circulatory system, then where does it go? One particular area? It goes everywhere where the blood goes. It can have an effect in one area because in order for a distant tissue to become sensitive to that product, it has to have a particular thing called a receptor, right? So a target tissue has to have a receptor in order to respond to that product that's being secreted by an endocrine gland. And then lastly, you got to be able to tell me, what is the product that an endocrine gland secretes? It is a hormone. That's right, a hormone, right? So a hormone is produced by an endocrine gland, secreted into the interstitial space. It's absorbed by the vascular system, delivered to a distant site where it can change the physiology of that tissue at that distant location if that target tissue has a receptor. And as a matter of fact, the definition of a target tissue is that it has a receptor. Can't be a target tissue unless it has a receptor. So there are two hormones, insulin and glucagon. And these two hormones, you've probably heard of insulin a lot, maybe not so much about glucagon, but you've heard of the biceps brachii and triceps brachii, right? You've heard of the quadriceps femoris and the biceps femoris. You've heard about the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system. And now you've heard about insulin and glucagon, and what do all of these pairs have in common? They're antagonistic to each other. And that's not a bad thing, that's a beautiful thing, because if you have antagonism in a control system, what does that allow that control system to do? It can maintain balance and precise control. Balance and precise control, just like your gas pedal and brake pedal in your car. Okay, so insulin decreases blood sugar. So when should the pancreas secrete insulin? When you're in a fasted state or when you're in a fed state? When does blood glucose go up? In a fed state, after you eat something, right? So And glucagon is released when you're in a fasted state that will increase blood glucose. And in a lot of cases, this glucagon gets sugar from your liver. It tells your liver to break down starch or glycogen. People really don't have starch, but they have something similar called glycogen. Glucagon goes to the liver, tells the liver to break down glycogen into glucose and release that glucose into the blood to maintain a proper level of glucose in your body. And of course, that has to be a normal, healthy person in order for that to work properly. Okay. All right, so as far as the anatomy of a pancreas, okay, you have to draw part of this in lab. All right, so here's the pancreas, here's the tail, here's the head, here's the main pancreatic duct, and there's an accessory pancreatic duct over here. Notice that the bile duct connects with the main pancreatic duct before it empties into the small intestine. And there's a papillae in the small, in the duodenum, which is part of the small intestine, right, that sticks out, which is at the opening of the main pancreatic duct. And there's a sphincter here that controls the opening of that duodenal papillae. We call that the hepatopancreatic ampule and sphincter. So there's a little bulge and a sphincter in there. Why do we call this the hepatopancreatic duct? I see where the pancreatic duct comes from. Well, what about this hepato? What does that mean? That's right. So there's a duct from the liver, right, that joins. So we call it by both of those names. And remember, that's the bile duct, and that's carrying bile from the liver. Can anybody remember what the function of bile is? It emulsifies fat so that fats can dissolve in water, right? Because oils usually don't unless they have something like a detergent to break them apart, right? And that's what emulsification means. Taking big fat globules or oil globules and breaking them down into smaller ones, right? And so don't forget, you got the gallbladder. Now, bile goes into the gallbladder when you're in a fed state or fasted state. So bile, because the liver is making bile all the time, 24 hours a day. Right? But it doesn't go to the small intestine 24 hours a day, at least in a normal individual. Where does it go? It goes into the gallbladder. When does it go into the gallbladder? When you're in a fed state or fasted state? When you're in a fasted state, right? It only goes to the small intestine when you're in a fed state, because that's when you have oils in your small intestine that need to be emulsified. All right, that's just kind of another exercise in fed state versus fasted state. And we could break your state into those two. All right, so that is the pancreas, which now takes us to the large intestine. So let's take a look at large intestine. All right, the small intestine empties into the large intestine. So here's the ileum. You told me that's the distal segment of the small intestine. And it empties into a part of the large intestine we call the cecum. All right, and I tell you what, before I go on, what was the function of the small intestine? Function of the small intestine. Yeah? Absorption and digestion, both of those. That's, as a matter of fact, the small intestine is the most important organ in your body for digestion and absorption, right? Because the stomach was mostly for just holding and mixing food with gastric juice, right? And the oral cavity, the stomach, and small intestine all emptied in about how many liters of fluid into the alimentary canal? Yeah, about 5. Well, you would dehydrate, right, if you lost that fluid, and that tells us pretty much what the function of the large intestine is to do what? Do I have it on this slide? Function? Water, yeah, water and salt absorption. Because you've lost all those liters of water, you dehydrate, so this is the job of the large intestine, to resorb, to take all that water, right, and some salts and put it back into your circulatory system, and no digestion takes place. All the nutrients should have been absorbed by the small intestine already before that contents, right, gets emptied into the large intestine. I'm going to come back to the function of the large intestine a little bit, but let's talk about some of the structures. All right, so I see a couple main features of some segments of the large intestine. We have the ascending colon. Large intestine and colon pretty much mean the same thing. Ascending on the right, transverse, right, over to the left side of the body, then a descending part of the colon, and that runs into this squiggly region that we call the sigmoid colon, and then the material enters the rectum, of course, where it's stored until there's a proper time for elimination, and then it passes through the anal canal outside of your body. All right, so what did we say? Let me go over a couple other structures. All right, so I see some of these pockets. These are called haustra. One is a haustrum. These are just smooth muscles, right? And they're connected to a ligament right here that we call the tinea coli. And then attached to the tinea coli, there's some of these little out pockets of adipose tissue that we call epiploic appendages. And okay, we all know that a ligament is there to have a muscle work on something. So that's an important attachment point for smooth muscle of the large intestine. But these epiploic appendages, I don't think anybody has the slightest clue why they are there. If you know why they're there or know a nice reference that you can point me to, that would be great. I'm sure they have some kind of function because why? They're there. All right, but we just don't know exactly why they're there. Okay. Say that again? To make it, a little bit more festive maybe. These little things just kind of hanging off. Okay. All right, so the connection between the ascending colon and the transverse, remember that's on the right side of the body. What's the major organ you have on the right side of the body? It is the liver, right? So the right colic flexure or hepatic flexure, exactly the same thing, right? Over on the left side, you have a stomach, but you got another smaller organ, part of the lymphatic system, which is the spleen, right? So the left colic flexure or the splenic flexure are exactly the same thing once again. Okay. All right. Okay, a couple more things. So the small intestine is there for absorption. And in your large intestine, you're resorbing or absorbing all that water that you've lost when secreted into the mouth and stomach and small intestine. So that's the job. And in so doing, when it's taking all that water out of that digested material, another way of talking about that is fecal production. Feces production, right? So feces production is when you take water back and put it into your body from all of that digested material. So they're kind of synonymous in this particular case. Fecal formation and absorption of water. All right. So normally the large intestine does a really good job of that. Sometimes it gets really irritated because every once in a while the small intestine doesn't do its job. And nutrients enter the large intestine, right? And in the large intestine, there are billions and trillions, billions, trillions, trillions, and trillions of bacteria that live in the large intestine, and they're contained in the large intestine because the large intestine contains malt, right, that prevents the entry into your body of all those normal microbiota, right? And so the job of those bacteria is to produce certain vitamins for us so that they do a pretty important job because we need those vitamins, right? But if actual nutrients were able to enter the large intestine, then all of those bacteria, what do you think they would do? Would they just sit around quietly or just have a really raging big party? They would have a really big raging party, okay? And they'd start to proliferate, which means it would grow, right? And produce a lot of gas and would distend the large intestine and would cause inflammation of the large intestine, and you wouldn't absorb all of that water like it should. And when nutrients enter the large intestine, that produces copious amounts of watery stool. What do we call that condition? Diarrhea, that's right. All right, so in this particular case, that diarrhea was caused by malabsorption of nutrients in the small intestine. And a lot of times when somebody has malabsorption, which is what? Producing copious amounts of watery stool, right? It is due to that inability of the small intestine to absorb an important nutrient that those bacteria, right, can start to metabolize and go nuts on. All right, so sometimes you might be taking a drug for one particular reason. One doesn't come to mind. But if you read the side effects, one of the side effects of a certain kind of pharmaceutical agent would be that it causes diarrhea. Right? And now you kind of know the mechanism. What could you guess? Why does some drug that you're taking produce diarrhea for you? because it blocks the absorption of a nutrient in your small intestine, right? And then it enters the large intestine, and again, those bacteria just go nuts. Okay, so that's kind of interesting to know something about that. There's a cancer that's particularly deadly. I'm not really current, but it used to be that in the United States alone, about 20,000 people would die of large intestine cancer. And that's a real shame, because even back then, a couple years ago, it was 100% treatable. If it was detected early, it has to be detected early. Otherwise, it's a very aggressive kind of cancer. Okay, and the best way to detect it early is to, all right, insert a camera up the anal canal rectum and investigate the surface of the sigmoid colon, or maybe even the descending colon, looking for polyps, looking for precancerous lesions. And those lesions then, with that same instrument, can be snipped and they can be sent out for pathology, and it can be diagnosed as an early form of cancer or a benign growth. And then proper steps can be taken before cancer really took over somebody's body. And in that particular case, surgery would remove that area and it would be 100% curable. All right, so that's a really shame. All these thousands, tens of thousands of people die. Right? And that procedure is what we call either a sigmoidoscopy or a colonoscopy. And so I forget what the exact guidelines are, probably around age 45, people should start being screened for that, especially if you have family history. If somebody in your family has had colon cancer previously, right, then you're a little bit more susceptible to getting colon cancer. And then what that means is that you need screening a little bit more frequently. Instead of every 10 years, probably every 5 or something like that, depending on what they find in your large intestine. Okay, now that's not a terribly bad procedure, but there's something that you have to do ahead of time that makes it kind of an obnoxious procedure, right? Because if somebody's going to look around with a camera in the descending or sigmoid colon over here, there can be nothing else in there, right? So what some doctors prescribe, and you should follow exactly what the doctor prescribes, some prescribe an enema-type solution that moves all the material out. But I think most doctors prescribe that you drink a gallon of something called Go Lightly, right? And Go Lightly is a real misnomer, because the last thing you're going to do is go lightly, okay? And as a matter of fact, you'll probably stay up all night going and going and going and going. It's called Lightly because it's spelled L-Y-T-E, which means electrolyte, like a sodium and potassium balance, so that it doesn't cause strange water imbalance or electrolyte imbalance inside your body. All right, so you really have to put your mind to it, okay? You can't just drink 3/4 of that gallon, because if you drink 3/4 of that gallon and go and get your exam, guess what the doctor is going to say, or the technician is going to say? I can't see well enough. You got to go home, and in 1 month, you got to repeat that 1 gallon, and this time, please drink the whole thing, right? So we call that preparation. You have to be prepped for this particular procedure. So what would you rather do? Drink 1 gallon of this really obnoxious, terrible tasting stuff, or 2 gallons, or 1 3/4 of a gallon? It's best just to do it right the first time, right? So follow the advice of your physician exactly, because, right, you want them to have a good look around of what's happening in there. All right, so that sort of reminds me of another thing. You can get a sigmoidoscopy. What part of the large intestine does a sigmoidoscopy investigate? Just the sigmoid colon, okay? And a colonoscopy, right, investigates part of the descending colon and sigmoid colon, right? So what do you think is a better examination, the sigmoidoscopy or the colonoscopy? Yeah, colonoscopy. Because sometimes when you get a sigmoidoscopy, you might get a report back that says, oh, inconclusive. We can't really diagnose for sure what's happening there. We have to reschedule you for a colonoscopy. In which case, what do you have to do? You end up drinking 2 gallons of this stuff, right? So if you have a choice, right, and sometimes we just don't have a choice, ask for a colonoscopy and not a sigmoidoscopy, because chances are you only have to go through it one time. It's a much better exam. Okay, so that's something interesting. So it's really sad when somebody dies of colon cancer, okay, because of these really modern investigation techniques, although it seems like it's not very, okay, it's kind of an obnoxious procedure, but if it can save your life and prevent you from getting cancer, then it's well worth it. And you should support all your family members in getting a colonoscopy at the prescribed time interval to prevent that from happening. Okay, so this is large intestine, bacteria produce that vitamin K. Oh, does anybody know what vitamin K is good for? Why do we need vitamin K in our body? Okay, vitamin K. I think I heard something about blood. Oh, I like that a lot. It's important for forming blood clotting factors. All right, and blood clotting factor, blood clotting function is so important because when you cut yourself, you don't want a hemorrhage to death. You would like to have a clot form after that, over that laceration very rapidly. So vitamin K is really important. And these bacteria need a certain food material to make this vitamin K. Does anybody know what bacteria need or what kind of food you should eat so that you can make proper vitamin K levels? It is green leafy vegetables, green vegetables. What's your favorite green type vegetable? Okay, broccoli, I think I heard broccoli. Yes, broccoli is fantastic. Okay, some people have to be on anticoagulation therapy because they have a tendency to form blood clots a little bit too quickly, too often, and they're on an anticoagulation therapy like Coumarin or heparin, and if they are, they can eat broccoli still, but they have to eat the same amount every day. They can't change their diet, right? Like they can't have like a ton of broccoli 1 week and then no broccoli the next, because then the dose for those anticoagulants is going to vary too much and it won't be useful. But right, if they're just on a constant diet, then those drugs can be titrated just perfectly so that they have proper blood clotting function. Right? So it's reduced a little bit, but not too much. Okay. Right, that's vitamin K. Got a lot of funny stories. Maybe in lab you can ask me about some funny stories about vitamin K, but don't have time right now. The liver. All right, so where the heck is this liver at? Nice liver right here. Right here, we got some in lab. This picture is a little strange. It's a little strange because we're looking at the posterior side, which means over here where I have the cursor, since we're looking from the back, where do I have the cursor, on the right side or the left side? It's on the right side. That's on the right side, but we want to look at some of these structures. So the biggest part of the liver is on the right, right? So take your liver when you're in lab, put it on your body the way it belongs. So here is the left. So I can see some lobes of the liver, namely the right, the left, right? The quadrate lobe, because it's nice and square or rectangular, and then the caudate, which is mostly posterior. And so what's the function of this thing? It can store a bunch of important compounds for us. I mentioned glycogen, and can anybody tell me the building block of glycogen? If we break glycogen down, what do we get? Yeah, we get sugars, in particular glucose. So it's a nice storage form of glucose. We store a lot of glucose in our liver, and as a matter of fact, the liver is the only tissue in our body that will give up glucose. Any other cell in your body, when they take glucose up from the blood, will never give it back to anybody else, right? But the liver is kind of altruistic in that sense. A whole bunch of vitamins like A, B12, D, E, K are stored in the liver, and then some ions as well, like copper and iron. Iron you need to make hemoglobin with. Copper is an important cofactor in some enzymatic reactions that your body needs. You don't need very much of these things, just trace very small amounts, but without them, right, you won't have proper function in your body. And then lastly, the liver can interconvert important compounds in our body. It can convert a precursor of vitamin D into an active form of vitamin D. We talked about K being important for blood clotting function. What about D? What's D important for? Okay, D is important for, it can help prevent osteoporosis. So vitamin D is necessary for absorption of calcium that we have in our diet. Right? Somebody won't be protected from osteoporosis if they have proper absorption. What else do they have to do? Don't throw anything at me. I'm just the messenger. I'm not responsible for it. You have to exercise as well, right? You have to stress those bones to take up calcium, right? Just like a muscle, if you want a bigger, stronger muscle, you can't just think about it. You got to exercise it, right? Same thing for bones. The liver can also interconvert fat and phospholipids. Ooh, who can remember way back when in January when we talked about phospholipids? What's a good function for a phospholipid? What does it make? It makes something. Membranes. All the membranes in your body are based on a phospholipid bilayer matrix, right? So all those membranes due to phospholipids. The liver can also convert amino acids, the building block of proteins, into sugar, and it can even convert protein into sugar into fat, right? So nice storage forms of energy, because fat is basically just energy in our body. The interesting thing, we don't have any enzymes anymore in our body that can convert fat into sugar. Our bodies love to convert sugar into fat, but not the reverse. Right? If we ever eat a fat, guess what it's going to stay? It doesn't have any other fate except it can be metabolized to produce energy. It can be converted into energy and carbon dioxide with exercise, unless you're on one of these really strange diets. Again, you'll have to talk to me in the lab about that, like an Atkins diet. But that can be really dangerous if you do that. Some other things that the liver can convert, it can take a very toxic form of protein or amino acid metabolism called ammonia, converted into urea, and that's a little bit less toxic, but the nice thing about urea is that it can be excreted by the kidneys. Ammonia can't. Ammonia just goes over everywhere in your body. It can't be grabbed and thrown away like urea can by the kidneys. And we mentioned also clotting factors. The liver makes a lot of clotting factors, right, to prevent blood loss. And another important thing, not on your list right here, it produces a protein called albumin. And albumin is really important because that prevents you from swelling up. Right, so that maintains a normal just water concentration in your body. And so if somebody has liver damage, one of the side effects of that or consequences of that is that you start to swell up when that happens. Right, so albumin is important for drawing water out of tissue spaces and putting it back into your cardiovascular system. Albumin. And liver damage does that. Liver damage also, since the liver sometimes is important in breaking down old and damaged red blood cells or the parts of chemicals that are released by red blood cells, namely hemoglobin, it produces something that's very yellow called bilirubin. And if the liver is damaged, bilirubin can build up in the body. And then what happens to the color on the outside of your body? Fingernails, whites of your eyes. Yeah, they become jaundiced looking, which means what? Bright yellow. So you see somebody with bright yellow features, that could be an indication of liver damage. And that might be due, maybe they're on some kind of chemotherapy agent to treat a cancer someplace in their body, but it's also affecting their liver as well. Okay, and hopefully, right, their liver function will come back. All right, so that's it for digestive system. Oh, one last thing. Sound like Columbo. About 10 years ago, somebody, a pharmaceutical company, was releasing a drug that would block the absorption of fats from your diet, right? So you wouldn't absorb those fats, so they released it as a way to help control weight gain in people or to lose weight because there's so much energy in fat, right? There's three times as much energy in fat compared to sugars or protein. So if a person can block that absorption of fat, then it's a whole lot easier to lose weight. Three times as easy compared to if they can't block it. That was called Xenical. Okay, but if lipids aren't absorbed, right, in your small intestine, where do they go? Yeah, they go into the colon or large intestine. And who is there ready to thank you? All those bacteria, right? And so then what happens? All those bacteria start to proliferate and grow and produce a bunch of gas, irritate the large intestine, that increases the motility, and that produces copious amounts of not only watery stool, but oily watery stool. And so that was one of the side effects. Can you imagine what happened to that drug? it was withdrawn from the market. Because when somebody was on Xenocalp, indeed they would lose weight, right? And they would have some problem with water and electrolyte imbalance, which could be dangerous, right? But they had no idea when they were stooling themselves. But not just regular watery diarrhea, but oily watery diarrhea. So if I was on Xenocalp trying to lose weight right here, what would I have to be wearing? A diaper. That's right, a diaper. So they withdrew it from the market, and I think it got resurfaced with a lower dose, and I can't remember what its ally. No, it's called Ally right now, right? But still, I don't know if I would even come close to that particular weight loss diet pill. Okay, but if you do, buy a pack of diapers too at the same time. Okay, that's it for digestive system. Anybody have any questions regarding digestive system? No, the two different kinds of motility. What are the two kinds of motility? Peristalsis and segmentation. Which one is the stomach mostly noted for? Okay. The stomach is there for holding and mixing. Yeah, not so much for digestion. Almost no absorption whatsoever. So which one of those motilities are important for mixing things? Segmentation, yeah, so the stomach is really set up for the kind of motility that we call segmentation, mostly mixing gastric juice with the food that we eat. Okay, questions? All right, well, we got to get to the topic that we wanted to talk about today, which was what? Urinary system. Nice. Urinary system. We can do that. Okay, so on the surface, the gross aspects of the urinary system are extremely simple because I see it right here on this slide. There's only four structures. Some of them are in pairs, but there's basically only four. There are two kidneys, which produce urine. That urine, when it's produced, right, is secreted into a ureter, and there are two ureters on either side, right, and the ureters go to the urinary bladder. Urinary bladder is, well, bladder right there, just like gallbladder, is to store that urine until there's an appropriate time to void. And then the urinary bladder is voided via the urethra. So those are the only four components of the urinary system. Those we can all see with our naked eye very easily. All right, so functions of the urinary system. Remove waste products from blood, kidneys. Right, are filtering blood all the time, removing things like urea or excess acids, maybe even too much water. Right, the kidneys remove from our body. Right, and when it removes water, or if it retains water, that helps control blood volume. If we take water out of our body, that reduces blood volume. And when your body adjusts naturally or artificially, that will help adjust blood pressure. Blood volume and blood pressure are directly related. If your blood volume goes up, your blood pressure goes up. Kind of like when you have a tire and you put air into a tire, what happens to the pressure inside the tire? Does it go up or does it go down or stay the same? It goes up, that's right. If there's too high pressure in your tire, what's one way that you can correct that? Yeah, you can take some air out, right? So blood volume and blood pressure pretty much are the same thing, very highly regulated, right? And also the kidney then can regulate electrolyte levels. And we don't study a lot of chemistry in this class, but we got to know what an electrolyte is. I mentioned it today. What's an electrolyte? It is an ion, right? So sodium in like table salt, when you put it in water, dissociates into an ion, a sodium ion. And we call it an ion because it has a charge of +1, and that's an electrical charge of +1, and hence when we say electrolyte, it is because it has an electrical charge on it. So a lot of electrolytes have positive charges. Some have two, like magnesium and calcium, and then there are some that have negative charges, like chlorine. And these are really important because we are extremely electrical beings. The electrical properties of our body are maintained by having the proper electrolyte levels inside our body. And kidneys help regulate pH. What is pH a measure of? Yeah, acidity. Now, here's something strange, and you're going to become really familiar with this when you get into physiology class. The pH number can go up and down, not by a lot, from about 1 to 14. That's not a big range, okay? But as the pH number goes from, say, right smack in the middle, which is 7, if it goes to 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, as the pH number is going down, what can you tell me about acidity? Yeah, the acidity is going up. So we call that an inverse relationship. As the pH number goes down, the acidity goes up, and it just becomes second nature to you once you think about it a bunch and use it in a physiology class. And also, the kidneys help regulate red blood cell production. And how important is that? How many red blood cells do you lose every second? I gave you this little tidbit months ago. How many red blood cells die in your body? About 2 million. About 2 million red blood cells die every second in your body. So, what do you call that condition when you run low on red blood cells? What's that called? Anemia. So what does your body have to do to prevent you from going into anemia? It's got to make 2 million red blood cells every second. So you've been really busy listening to lecture just making red blood cells, right? And it's the job of the kidney to help regulate that red blood cell production, right? And there's a compound, there's a hormone actually that the kidney secretes. It's called erythropoietin. And that stimulates red bone marrow to make more red blood cells when oxygen concentration goes down in your blood. All right, so is the kidney an endocrine gland? Is the kidney an endocrine gland? It is, because it secretes erythropoietin into the blood, which goes to red bone marrow, and red bone marrow has a receptor for that particular hormone. So yes, you probably never thought of the kidney as a endocrine gland, but it does, because it helps control what? The production of red blood cells. So there's a lot of organs in your body that you don't necessarily recognize right away as an endocrine gland, but it is. All right, so where are these kidneys at? Well, you got two of them, right? If you're normal, they're about as big as your fist, and they're kidney bean shaped. I see right here. And they're sort of close to the abdominal cavity. Here's the pelvic cavity. Here's the abdominal cavity. But remember, lining the abdominal cavity is the peritoneal membrane. And it just so happens that these kidneys are not in the abdominal cavity. They're behind that membrane. So the peritoneal membrane covers the surface of the kidney. So in lab, you're going to have to dig through that membrane to find them. So the kidneys are kind of embedded in some fat pads and muscles of the back to protect it. And since they're outside the abdominal cavity and behind the peritoneal membrane, we call them retroperitoneal. Which means what? Just right behind the peritoneal membrane. Okay, they're not suspended in mesentery like the rest of the abdominal organs are. All right. Well, you see this little indentation on a kidney right here? Okay, so here is the surface that's lateral. This medial part of the kidney is where this ureter exits. So urine is exiting the kidney right in this space, right? It contains the renal vein, so blood is leaving the kidney right at this particular space. And then here's the renal artery that enters the kidney right in this region. So this is the gateway to the kidney, and sometimes we call that the hilum or the hilus of the kidney. You don't see arteries or veins entering or leaving the kidney at any other location except the hilum of the kidney, right? And if you look at a kidney bean in real life, I think I have one in lab, you notice that a kidney bean has like a little white spot right here, and that's where it's connected to the bean pod or the mother plant. And guess what we call that area on a kidney bean? That's called the hilum as well, okay? That's the connection point to the rest of the organism. Right, so sometimes that's a little obscure, but that's really all there is to it. All right, so let's look inside a kidney. Now we're going to get a little bit more. Here's a nice figure for your lab quiz. So here's a nice coronal section. Remember, here's that entrance or exit to the kidney. That's the hilum. Here's the renal artery. Here's the renal vein. And when I look at the kidney, does it look homogeneous? Does it look all the same? Do you see structures in there? Yeah. Okay. And remember, the superficial part of an organ is called the... What's the superficial part of bone called? The cortex, that's right. So the kidney has a cortex. Here is the cortex. That looks pretty homogeneous. All of this is cortex. And then the deeper part of the kidney over here, I see a lot of variability, that is the medulla, right? The medulla is always the deeper part of any organ. Okay, you've got cortex and medulla. There's a nice capsule, fibrous capsule around the kidney that helps give it some stability. If we look in the medulla, I see generally two kinds of structures. I see things that have this triangular shape to them. Okay, and but don't forget this is just two dimensions. In real life, it'd be three dimensions. It would be a cone or a pyramid. So these are what we call the renal pyramids in the renal medulla, right? So here is a pyramid, this triangular shaped thing. And in between the pyramids, there's something that looks like it goes straight up and down. That's a column. So pyramids and columns you find in the renal medulla. Okay. So the pyramids are responsible for producing urine. It's got a special unit in there that produces urine, and there's millions of them, and they all lead, when they produce urine, to the tip of this pyramid, and this is called a papillae, right? And then urine seeps out of this papillae into this space right at the tip of this renal papillae. This is called a calyx. A calyx is a collecting basin for urine. And this is what we call a minor calyx. A minor calyx receives urine from just one pyramid. So here's another minor calyx. I see one here. I see one, another minor. Here's another minor calyx. And here's another one. But notice, minor calyces join together. They anastomose. They join together. And where they do that is a major calyx. Right? So I see a bunch of calyces. And I see a bunch of minor ones, and I see a few major calyces here, or major calyx. The major calyces join together to form another collecting basin that we call the renal pelvis. And it kind of looks like a funnel, and that's its job, because the renal pelvis funnels urine into the ureter. And where does the ureter take urine then? To the urinary bladder, right. Okay. There are some spaces inside the kidney, deep inside the medulla, like I see one right here. Right? It's not part of the calyx, not part of a pyramid, but here's just a little space. Sometimes we call this the renal sinus, but that empty space is never just lost. It's utilized for something. So what is this space inside the kidney used for? I see it right there. You could analyze that and tell me what it is. Here's part of the renal sinus filled with, I hear it, fat. Yeah, so it's a storage form of energy. So the kidney helps store a little bit of energy for us in the form of fat. Okay. Well, what I didn't tell you, all of these things within a pyramid that produce urine is what we call the structural and functional unit of urine formation. And so we got to know a lot about that structural and functional unit. Right, because that's what the kidney is doing. It's producing urine. And in so doing, it does all those other functions that we mentioned. And you got to know the name of that structural and functional unit of urine formation. It is the nephron. You're right. And remember how important that was? What's the structural and functional unit of contraction called? Sarcomere. What's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells? The synapse. I think I heard synapse. I'm not quite sure. What's the structural and functional unit of life? A cell. That's right. So if you know that structural and functional unit, you know how that whole structure works. If you know a sarcomere, you know everything about skeletal muscle, basically how it contracts, right? If you know something about a cell, you know about life, right? Because that's the basic unit of life. So if you want to know how urine is produced, you got to know something about a nephron. Right here. Okay. So, this is where we're going to have some fun, I think. I hope, in class. Do I have something that looks like a nephron? I only have something that's really complicated in your book. Okay, something really complicated. And I need to make it a lot simpler for you. Okay, looks way too complicated. Well, I see two nephrons right here. These lines These are what we call the arcuate arteries and veins. This is the line that separates the cortex, which is up over here, from the medulla. All right, so I see some of the nephrons are in the cortex and some pieces are down in the medulla, and then there's other kinds of nephrons where there's some piece in the cortex, but a lot down in the medulla. They have basically two different kinds of functions. All right, so let's work on this nephron. So what do you got to do? What do you got to do when you got something that's complicated? Yeah, like your finances. Break it down into smaller components, right? Okay. And for the nephron, it's not too bad because there's only two components that we have to break it down into. All right, so let's get started with that. The first thing, number one, I'll write right here. Hopefully you can see this. It's on the slide that I'm projecting as well. These are what we're going to call tubular elements. Tubular elements, and there's a special flow pattern, and I'm going to write down the names of these elements in the order that something has to flow through them. Right, so that's important. Like in the vascular system, it would be what? Artery, arteriole, capillary, venule, vein, then back to the heart. All right, so for tubular elements, the first thing is, okay, it's going to be called Bowman's capsule. This is it. Bowman's capsule. So there's a fluid in there, and that fluid is going to flow into a tube connected to Bowman's capsule, and it has a bunch of twists and turns to it. Remember, the surface of the brain, is it flat and smooth, or does it have a bunch of twists and turns? It's got a bunch of twists and turns. If we add those gyri and sulcus together, what do we say about the surface of the brain? It is convoluted, right? A convolution is part gyrus, part sulcus, right? So here is the what we call the proximal convoluted tubule. Right, then the fluid in this is proximal because it's closest to Bowman's capsule. That's why it's called proximal. Then that fluid is going to go down into the medulla via the descending loop of Henle. And then it's going to come back up into the cortex via the ascending loop of Henle. All right, well, if there is a proximal convoluted tubule, guess what? There's got to be a distal convoluted tubule as well. And then the last tube is called the collecting duct. And that collecting duct, right, has urine in it, and it takes it to the tip of that renal pyramid, which we call a papillae, and then it goes into that minor calyx. All right, so these are all tubular elements. The other kind of element, number two, are what we're going to call vascular elements. Okay, and what kind of material is in a vascular element of what we're talking about? Blood, yeah. Vascular system. So we're going to put blood right here. All right, I'll put that in parentheses, but I forgot something. What are we breaking down? We're taking a big complex thing, breaking it down into its pieces, and what's that big complex thing that we're breaking down? The nephron, right? So I forgot to label this, right? Nephron. All right, and the nephron, remember, is the structural and functional unit of urine formation. Okay, let's get back to vascular elements. The first one that has blood is called the afferent arteriole. And where does arteriole bring blood to, typically? A capillary, right? This is a really special capillary. It's got a special name, right? It's called the glomerulus. And everybody's got to say that because otherwise you might not know how to say it, I mean spell it. So it's what? Glomerulus. Glomerulus. Can you say glomerulus? Glomerulus. Yeah, glomerulus. That's nice. Okay. And that's a capillary. So let's put that in parentheses. Capillary. And we're going to put capillary number one. All right. Then blood from the glomerulus feeds into something we call the efferent. And this is strange. Arteriole. And what does arteriole bring blood to? A capillary, right? Another capillary. These are what we're going to call the peritubular capillaries. This is number two. And then blood goes into a venule and then back to the heart. So this is a special circulatory system. Usually you have an arteriole, a capillary, and a venule. And it goes back to the heart. That's a typical circulatory system. What do we call one that has two capillary beds back to back separated by this particular little vessel? That is a portal system, right? So here is another example of a portal system. The efferent arteriole is really a portal blood vessel, like the hepatic portal vein, for instance. All right, so these are vascular elements that contain blood. The tubular elements, right, have a fluid that's produced in Bowman's capsule by a process called filtration. And you've done that. Maybe you made coffee or tea or something today. Right, through a process of filtration. And in chemistry, what do we call that material that comes through the filter? Filtrate. Right. So the stuff that's in these tubular elements is filtrate. And if something stays in filtrate, where does it end up? It ends up in urine. Okay. If it stays in the blood, then it stays in your body, but if it's in filtrate, you lose it when you urinate. Okay, so those are the structures. So I think you've written them down someplace so you know that proper list. All right, so I think let's draw it out one time. You have a really nice interactive exercise in Blackboard that I made for you one time. Not a drag and drop, but it's sort of like a hover exercise. I didn't log in, so I can't really show you. But in lab, I'll show you. Let me draw it here. Should we start with tubular elements or vascular elements? I don't want to draw both at the same time because that will defeat the purpose. We want to make it simple. Let's start with tubular elements first. Okay. All right, and there's that list. They got to be connected to each other. So here is, what's our first thing? Bowman's capsule. I'm going to abbreviate it so it doesn't get too complicated. Then here's a tube coming out of Bowman's capsule. And what can you tell me about that tube? Does that look convoluted? Absolutely. And this is what, the PCT? Like so. And then what happens? Down into the medulla, right? And this is called the DLH, descending loop of Henle. And this arrow signifies the flow of this fluid. What's the name of this fluid flowing down here? Yeah, it's filtrate. You'll lose that, right, when you urinate unless something happens. And then here is the ascending loop of Henle. Right? So we're back up into the cortex. And then what do we got to have here? Another convoluted tubule called the distal convoluted tubule, and then this goes into the collecting duct, right? And this goes to the renal papillae, right? Tip of a renal papillae where urine is. So in the collecting duct, we have urine. And all these other tubes, we have filtrate. So that's pretty much there is only for the tubular elements. And what's next? Vascular elements. Here's a blood vessel bringing blood into Bowman's capsule. This is the afferent arteriole. Here is a special capillary inside Bowman's capsule. That's called the glomerulus. Yeah, glomerulus. Blood flows out of glomerulus into the efferent arteriole. All right, so blood is going like this, like this. And then this is a continuous blood vessel. that does what? It surrounds all of these tubes. All of these tubes, and then it leaves via a venule. So this thing right here, since it surrounds all of these tubes, this is the peri, which means surrounding, peritubular, and it's a capillary. Peritubular capillary. I think if you draw that out a couple times, it won't be too bad, especially if you look at that exercise in Blackboard. And that looks, what's a much better diagram? The one that's in your book where I have the cursor kind of floating over right now, the one that's in your book, or mine? Which one is better, your instructor's or the one that's in your book? Yeah, how come everybody didn't yell that? Mine is a lot better. Okay. And I think you should be able to draw it in maybe 60 seconds or so, as a matter of fact. And I have some students in lab that actually want to show you guys, okay, that particular thing. And I'm recording this, so I can't say your names, but why don't you come on down now? Are you guys ready? You guys ready to do this? I think you are. I'm going to erase some of the board. So you can do it here. Here's two colors. If you want to, maybe is a good thing. Okay. All right. And then our third. Guess what? I got to erase this right here. Okay. Here. Oh, don't fall off the stage, though. Okay. So I think we have an athlete here because she asked me if they're racing.
Nope.
Well, sort of. Okay, let's get started. Let's just see how you guys are doing. I'll get out of the way. Well, looks familiar so far. Proximal convoluted tubule, I like that. Just descending loop, ascending loop of Henle. Okay. CT, distal convoluted tubule, I like that. And then, nice. Collecting duct, yeah, we got urine in that collecting duct. Oh, sweet. You're not even getting help from the audience. They would like to help you. So you could ask for help. Peritubular capillary, nice too. Venule. You're great. That was 47 seconds. Sweet, 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 sweet. Yeah, peritubular capillary. Nice. I think everybody's done. There's about a minute. Everybody got done in a minute. That is fantastic. So I know you guys can all do that if you draw it out a couple times. All right? Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you, thank you. That's okay. Nice going. Oh, yeah. So what do we call this structural and functional unit of urine formation? This is a nephron. Yeah, okay. All right, that is super. All right, so you got the vascular elements, blah, 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 blah. Okay. All right, well, you might be interested to know, this is a really nice diagram right here. You might be interested to know how we get urine out of here. Right, so what do we start with? We started with, okay, filtrate. So I'm going to just draw a little dot and an arrow. Here we have some kind of substance that's in glomerulus. We've got substance in glomerulus. And where is it located if it's in the glomerulus? It's in the blood, right? And it's going to move out of blood into Bowman's capsule. We're going to call this process number one. All small molecules can end up in Bowman's capsule. So number one is what we call filtration. That's filtration. And we lose a tremendous amount of water, because water is a small molecule. It ends up in filtrate. We would dehydrate, I calculated this one time, but I forgot the exact number, within minutes, right? Because so much water is lost by filtration that water needs to be taken back and put into your body. So water's in filtration. Right, so here is filtrate in this proximal convoluted tubule, and it goes back into the blood. We're going to call this number 2. So we don't lose all that water in our urine. That one, 2, is called resorption. And if you want to say tubular resorption, that would be fine with me too. Tubular resorption. So water ends up in filtrate. That needs to be put back in your body. Glucose is filtered as well. Glucose ends up in the proximal convoluted tubule. And where do you think glucose should go? Should it be excreted in urine? Yeah, it should go back in the body, because glucose is a very important energy molecule. You don't want to lose any in urine. That would be like going to the gas station, filling your gas tank up with gas, and then taking an ice pick and putting a hole in your gas tank and letting gas dribble out of it, right? So we want to have all the glucose from the filtrate go back into the body. And in a normal individual, all of it does. None is lost in urine, unless somebody has diabetes mellitus. Then they can lose some, right? Maybe even a lot in urine. Guess how diabetes mellitus was diagnosed years ago? If you're losing glucose in urine, it would taste sweet. We do that in a physiology lab, but still take physiology lab anyway, even though you have to do that, okay, because it's a good class. Okay, resorption. Okay, so water, sugar, some electrolytes like sodium can be resorbed, take from filtrate, put back into the blood. But not all harmful compounds that are in blood get filtered, so that stays in your body, except here's another process. It can take stuff that's in the blood, right? So I put that dot right on that peritubular capillary, and it can stick it into a tubule. That's process number 3. And process number 3 is, I'll spell the whole thing out, tubular secretion. Number 3. All right, so that's pretty nice and simple. How many processes does your body require, or your kidney require, to make urine? How many? There are 3. There are just 3. And what are their names? Filtration, resorption, and secretion. And after those 3 processes take place, what do you end up with? Urine. Yeah. Okay. So that tells us a lot about those kidneys, and I think I need to finish a couple things next time. Maybe I'll go over the vascular system of a kidney, look at that a little bit, and make sure you sign the sign-in sheet and practice drawing that nephron out, because that's going to be on the quiz. That's quiz number 10. Draw nephron out. Okay? I'll give you all the abbreviations, and then you have to tell me what the abbreviations mean, and then label your diagram. And you can do it in one color. You don't need 2 colors necessarily to do that.